Open your eyes. Welcome to the Roy Harper Podcast. This is episode number 15 for October 2008. In this show, we have first of all a news update, then an interview with Dave Cochran, the A to Z of Harper. This month it's the letter N, some listener feedback, and the usual wide selection of music.
My feet are firmly on the ground, but my mind is off at the speed of sound. White scarf and plastic bear floating through troubles.
So, first a news roundup. Last night, my wife and I went to the Royal Albert Hall, where the Levellers were headlining and Nick was doing a support slot. Nick played for about 45 or 50 minutes, and the highlight for me really was the last track, which he got his daughter Lily on stage for, and they sang Our House. Now, those of you that listened to the Roy Harper interview in the last three episodes will remember that Roy said that he'd done the same thing at the Albert Hall way back when Nick was very young, and Nick had sat on his knee and sung Our House. So that was a really nice sort of closing the circle moment. Nick went down pretty well, although I have to say I think the guitar sound was a bit lacking. It sounded very muddy, although his voice was in terrific form. Talking of Nick is embarking on the Peru Rocks endeavour, October the 6th through to the 17th. It's another charity thing in aid of Love, Hope, Strength. And to find out more about that, go to www.perurocks.org. That'll give you info and how to donate. If it's anything like the Everest expedition, there'll be podcasts and updates on there, and it's really good to follow what these guys are doing. There's also some Roy Harper news. There's a US CDs reissue initiative on the way, underway actually. It's already started, and I found a press release on Vintage Guitar Magazine's website. It says Harper is releasing a series of his seminal albums in the United States for the first time through Koch Entertainment Distribution via its distribution deal with London-based Caddies Music. The initial batch of releases will include Stormcock, Jugular, Flatbrock and Berserk, as well as a 2-CD best of Counterculture. Harper has been revered for decades by visionary musicians from Led Zeppelin. They wrote Hats Off to Roy Harper in 1970. And Pink Floyd, he sang lead on Have a Cigar from Wish You Were Here to Joanna Newsom most recently. This deal marks the first official US release of these recordings, which were previously only available as imports in this country. These newly restored and repackaged albums are released on Harper's own Science Fiction record label in exclusive distribution partnerships with Caddies Music in the UK and Koch in the US. Additional Harper titles to be released later in 2008 include The Green Man, The Dream Society, The Unknown Soldier, and Death or Glory. White scarf and plastic bear floating through troubles. To add to that, and by way of a stop press item, I got an email from Tracy Harper this morning letting me know that there's a new diary entry up on Roy's site. If you haven't looked at this before, there's a section on Roy's site at royharper.co.uk which contains kind of essays, thoughts, etc. Kind of like a blog, actually. And he's put the first part of his essay on Stormcock, The Code in the Artwork, which again was mentioned in the recent interview. www.royharper.co.uk/shop/display_page.php?page=diary/index. Well, yeah, go to royharper.co.uk and have a click around and you'll find the diary there and you'll find the new article. I've only briefly scan read it so far. I think there's going to be a lot to get our teeth into there. Okay, now our first music track this time around is going to be Referendum, and this is in order of our interview with Dave Cochran, who we'll find out more about presently, but this is from the BBC Tapes Volume 5, so it's a live rendition.
Thank you. was a man from Muddleborough, whose problems he laid down upon another's doorstep in a distant stranger's town. But forgetting what he'd come for, and in patronizing tones, he gave them all his clothes and bread to stop their moans and groans. Born, he said, all condescending, we cannot all be made like me with lots of true blue blending. But never mind, I'll pass the hat around our gracious nation. The strangers held their laughter back, remembering their station. Gathered by firesides.
Now the interview. This is an interview with Dave Cochran, who played bass with Roy during the 70s in the bands Trigger and Black Sheep. And Dave was in the UK. Actually, this was recorded back in July. I've had a bit of a backlog of interviews to get out, obviously because of the massive Roy one. And he met me in a pub in Camden. This was kindly arranged for us by Lynn Branson, who actually is Nick Harper's PR lady. And she managed to get him to agree to be interviewed by me, and we had an awful lot of fun, as I think you'll hear. Okay, I'm very lucky this month to have Dave Cochran sat in front of me. Dave is over in London from the US for a few days, and he contacted me on the MySpace account and said, "Hey, you're doing a good job with the Roy Harper podcast," and foolishly offered to come and be interviewed. And so here we are, sat outside a pub in Camden, which is why there's a lot of background traffic noise. So those of you on headphones can probably get a nice surround sound effect there. But anyway, Dave, let's start off by finding out a bit about your background, really. You're mid-50s, aren't you? 54?
Yeah.
Or shouldn't I be talking about that particularly?
Doesn't matter. I can't do anything about that.
Age like a fine wine, that's what I say anyway.
Age disgracefully in my case.
So you live in the US at the moment, is that
Nashville.
Right? Nashville, Tennessee. Oh, how's that working out for you then? How long have you been there?
I love it.
You love it.
I'm not playing as much, but I'm writing songs and having other people record the songs.
Right.
But I've worked with a lot of really good, like Vince Gill and Oak Ridge Boys, David Allan Coe, tons of different country artists.
We'll talk about the music in more detail in a minute. How did you first get involved with music? Now, I looked at your MySpace page.
For girls.
And there, yeah, well, obviously. Yeah. I looked at your MySpace page.
I was too short to get the women any other way.
And I saw, and I saw your biography, and it said you started off as a drummer.
Right.
And then switched. What's the story
there? Terrible.
What's the story there?
We had a band when I was 14, maybe. I played drums. I was terrible. The bass player we had, he was terrible. So we finally figured it out. Why don't we trade? You know, you play the drums, I'll play the bass. And that's, we started making money, so obviously it worked.
So you were obviously a better bass player than drummer, and he actually could keep time on the drums. Right, no, yeah, completely. Now, what happened after then? Because you seem to have done an awful lot of session work, and then at some point you came to the UK, didn't you?
I was working at Stax. And like went right before Stax went out, and there was no more Stax.
Right.
Like there is no more Stax these days, even still. But did some of the last records at Stax. Do you remember a song called Disco Duck? A real kind of corny song?
I think I do, yeah.
I recorded, well actually I wrote the next two records that that guy did, Rick Dees.
Right.
So I wrote his next two records, and I played on, them, but I also hired the Barcades to come in and play on, you know, to get that real funk.
Right.
And I had met this band called the Sharks. They were playing in Memphis. They were on tour with the band called Mountain back then. And I was really impressed. I mean, I liked the Sharks before I went to see them, obviously. But got to be kind of friends with them, but not as much. Another friend of mine named Robert Johnson, guitar player, he was good friends with Chris Spedding.
Who is a legend in and these parts.
Spedding called Robert and said, well, we're looking for a bass player. And I actually asked Robert if he wanted to play bass. And Robert said, no, I'm a guitar player, but I got a good friend. So I sold everything I had, bought a ticket, and took a chance.
You actually just genuinely sold up, bought a ticket, and came out on spec.
Yeah.
Amazing.
And got the Sharks gig.
Wow.
Over 200 bass players.
Oh, that is just incredible.
But I knew every... Andy Frazier was the original bass player in charge. Yeah. I knew every one of his licks back to front.
Right. So you had a good chance.
Oh, yeah.
What would you have done if it hadn't worked out?
Stayed and found something else. But,
yeah,
well,
I don't know. I just jumped in with both feet, you know.
Yeah, I did.
Brilliant.
And our first record, John Dentwistle produced. Mm-hmm. I was so naive and all that back then, you know, I was like, they must have really thought that this guy's just not got much sense at all.
What year was that then? When
75. 74, right. Actually. 74.
Okay.
Because our first gig was at the Marquee on October 13th.
Oh, I remember the Marquee. Well, it's all shut now.
Is it?
Yeah, it is. I went to see loads of gigs there. A tiny little place.
I played there a
few
times.
Huge atmosphere.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So, obviously, then, people listening to this will be interested in the Roy Harper angle, I suppose. So, yeah. I mean, how did that...
Well, how that happened is because Chris was the guitarist.
Yeah.
With Sharks, and then... In the meantime, we went on and cut Motorbike, and I don't know if you remember Motorbike. It was Chris's single.
I might do.
Motorbike.
Yeah.
Motorbike. Good to be alive. You know, whatever, that's it.
Yeah.
And then, so it came up that Harper asked Spedding to do the HQ album.
Right.
And so, I don't know how it happened, but Spedding said, why don't you use Dave to play bass?
Mm.
And we got in the studio at Abbey Road. And the drummer they had called for the session, I can't remember his name, but he used to play with Spooky Too. But right. I mean, no offense to the guy, I'm sure he's a great guy, but he's...
It didn't match. Yeah.
So my friend Robert Johnson was doing a record called Flash Fearless with Dentwistle and a whole bunch, and Bill Bruford.
Who is another legend.
So I met Bill Bruford at that session, even though I didn't play on it, and I didn't really know him.
Yeah.
But I said, hey, why don't you call Bruford and we'll get him on
that. All right.
And so then it started, it fell together then. And that's how that happened. And then we toured.
Well, Bill Bruford is one of my heroes because I like Bill. A lot of the proggy stuff. As listeners to the podcast will know, I like long, complicated.
Well, he actually taught me different time signatures and stuff because I was just
his stuff with King Crimson is mind-bogglingly technically excellent. You know,
when we would do live gigs, he would just completely turn the beat around. You know, like where the bass drum should be, he'd put the snare and you know reverse it all, and it's like, hold on, you know, I'm gonna hold on, keep gonna go, I'm gonna go, he'll eventually come back. I hope. And it's
that element of danger, I think, that makes it more exciting to listen to. Yeah?
I've got some of the gigs we did. I got tapes that I taped the gigs.
I'll be talking to you about that later. So the HQ band was put together really for session purposes,
but
then worked so well you went out on the road, because that's seen as a real high point in Roy's career, that the band sound. Yeah. Until then, obviously, that some of the records have had the bands on them, but he hadn't actually toured with a band as such.
Yeah.
And that is seen as one of his most sort of best times in terms of songwriting, music, and everything, really.
Some of my most enjoyable. I had a great time touring. And everybody was always joking with each other, so.
Yeah.
There was one night we played, I forget where it was, Plymouth or somewhere. And, you know, you have those hoses that have the dry ice fog that comes out.
Right, yeah.
They put it right on my amp, so when it started up, I'm just covered in this shroud of dry ice, and everybody goes, oh, you know. It was fun.
So, I mean, what was it like working with Roy in those days?
It was real good because I didn't really know Roy, and the only way I knew about Roy was Led Zeppelin 3.
Yeah, that's how I got to hear about him in the first case. Yeah,
and got to meet him, and actually we became better friends at the time. Then it was more of a friendship rather than a professional musician kind of thing. He even. One day I was at home in Memphis, and I get the phone call, and it's Roy. He said, I'm in Memphis.
Oh, right.
I said, okay, I'll come get you.
It's one of the things a lot of people say that have worked with him or know him is he's very uncompromising in his approach.
Totally.
Very, very exacting about what he wants done.
Totally.
I mean, that obviously got reflected in the studio when you were working with him.
Yes. Yeah.
He's very fastidious. I mean, I've not seen him recording, but I've seen him when he was mixing or doing the final master of one of the later albums, and the amount of attention to detail, I've never seen anything like it.
Yeah,
you know. There you go. I mean, if you're an artist, you deserve to give your best, I think.
Well, and that's what he does. Yeah, what you hear in your head.
Well, that's right. You try and get the nearest you can to it.
Yeah.
So, HQ, and then you played on one of the on Bullion and Ming's Vars one of those days in England. And presumably that was on. I mean, what?
That was a different band.
That was a different band, wasn't it? I guess you crossed over to that just because of the friendship, I suppose. And
I was the only one out of the bands that stayed with Roy.
Yeah, that's right.
We did an American tour.
Because the HQ band was called Trigger.
Right.
And the other band was
Chips.
Chips.
Roy Harper and Chips.
That was it, yeah. Trigger and Chips, yeah.
No ketchup, just Chips. That was Andy Roberts. I can't think of the keyboard player's last name. Yeah, John Halsey.
That's it.
Henry McCulloch.
Uh-huh.
Dave, who played?
Roberts.
Andy Roberts. Was
Andy
the,
Roberts.
Yeah, and Dave was the keyboard player.
Oh, I'll keep myself
but
as
he's,
well.
But he's done a lot of stuff. He did, like, all the keyboard stuff on David Bowie's Hunger, movie. He did all the incidental music.
Oh, and Andy Roberts as well. Roy did a tour with Andy Roberts a couple of years ago. Maybe 4 years ago. The years tend to compress when you get older, don't they?
Yeah.
And Andy was a brilliant accompanying guitarist then as well, and it was really good to see that. They were obviously friends as well, you know.
Yeah,
I want to get him on the interview, actually. You know,
he's a really cool
guy. At the moment.
I went to see a play once a few years back when I was here, and Andy did the kind of the music for the play.
Mm.
And he made all these little instruments and stuff for people to play.
Oh, yeah.
He made them himself. It was really cool.
All right. I suppose it's time to ask Roy's question. He said to ask you to tell the audience about jumping out of a hotel room into a swimming pool. Does that mean anything to you at all?
Which time?
I've told you all I know, and he wouldn't tell me anymore.
We did a lot of things. We were in Berlin once.
Right.
And Henry McCulloch was goose-stepping down the hall. It was a hotel called Hotel Am Zoo. And obviously the staff got word of it. So they were on their way to throw us out.
Right.
Then, you know, by the lifts, they have these potted plants and stuff.
Sure.
So he just commences to have a wee there. So they're coming up. They're going to Henry's room. We're on about third or fourth floor. Henry goes out on the ledge, crawls down the ledge to my room. We sneak out because we know we're thrown out.
Might as well go out in style, you know, rather than just being led out. Yeah.
I checked out of many. The one he's probably talking about was in Beverly Hills. I'd run and jump off the roof of the hotel into the swimming pool.
Well, I interviewed him recently and I asked him about the mid-70s and he said, yeah, I did a lot of stupid things then and I had a great time, but I kind of wish I hadn't now.
Yeah.
But, you know, that's a product of its time, I think. I think people made the most of it.
We were staying, how we wound up at that hotel, we were staying at another hotel that was down the street with a troubadour and Tom Waits was living there.
Oh, yeah.
I didn't know at the time. Mm. Found out when we moved out. But like the girl that was next door to my room, I think there were girls there that were like hookers or whatever.
Yeah.
And they had a deal worked out with the guy, you know, the owner of the hotel. So I'm sitting out on the balcony and just looking, and she comes out and makes her proposition. You know, I don't know about that. And I told Roy about that, so we get a new hotel.
I wondered for a minute where that story was going to end, but yeah.
That's how we wound up jumping off the roof of the hotel in the swimming pool.
Okay.
We changed hotels.
So you lived in London for how long?
10 years, off and on.
So when did you make the permanent trip back to the US?
Actually, I made a permanent one back in '80.
Okay.
But I kept coming back, and I still come back. But just for trips.
Yeah, yeah.
Last time I was here, you know Blair Cunningham?
No, I don't.
He played drums for Paul McCartney and Haircut 100 and Pretenders. But he's from Memphis. I brought him over here to play with Mick Ronson and Philip Rambo. I thought he was a better drummer. And since we were the rhythm section, I wanted somebody
you can rely on. Yeah.
Now, what was I talking about?
Well, we were talking about you going back to the U.S. And then.
Okay. So I brought him over and we were playing with Phil Rambo and all that. The band moved to New York then, with Philip Rambo, and then it got so expensive, and we were with EMI, I believe, at the time.
Right.
So, because it was so expensive in New York, we went on to Toronto and stayed there, and then things kind of started falling apart because that tour didn't go too well.
Okay.
They weren't accepting that music at the time. And Blair decided to come back, and like an idiot, I went back to Memphis.
Right.
But I saw him yesterday.
Okay. Obviously in London somewhere.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He hasn't done anything in ages. I guess he made too much money with McCartney.
That'd be a nice situation to be in, wouldn't it? But
he actually invited me to do a gig with him October 25th, some kind of charity gig.
Right.
I don't remember exactly what it was, but I might come do that.
Okay. Well, that leads on to the obvious next question. What have you been up to? What should people be listening to that you've done other than Roy's stuff?
Ooh.
What are you most proud of? What really gets you fired up?
There is one record that I'm really proud of, but you can't find it. It's only on MySpace.
Right.
A guy from Boston called John Carbo. And it's the weirdest thing. Once we recorded the music, the record company said, well, we don't know how to market this.
Oh, I've heard that before.
But it was everything kind of like from almost Bowie-ish to soulful, because it had horns. And
yeah.
We had some of the original Mad Lads from back in the 60s from Stax did all the backup singing.
Uh-huh.
Memphis horns play on it. And to me, it was one of the better things for that type of music anyway.
Was it ever released? So you just stuck some tracks on MySpace. Well, that's fine. People can go there and listen to it for a start, you know.
They're on MySpace.
Yeah. I mean, what have you been doing in recent years? You mentioned more country stuff before.
I've been mostly just writing.
Yeah.
And having people do my songs that way.
Oh, brilliant.
I'm trying to get George Jones to cut a song I wrote now.
Right.
It's about whiskey.
Okay.
Either I stop loving whiskey or she'll stop loving me. I think it's a good one for her.
Yeah, that sounds good.
Catch him before he goes away.
You mentioned labels, and that's there's a quote on your MySpace page because it's
about no labels. Record label.
You said none. Is there really a need for a label? And I'm interested in this because every person I get on the podcast, be they a musician or a fan, I like to ask them about what the current state of play with music and selling music and producing music.
One thing, because of the internet now, there are so many bands. There's some friends of mine, for an example. In Memphis, they're like a rap band called 666, mm-hmm. or 36 Mafia.
Right.
They own everything. They don't, it's not a label, it's them.
Yeah.
I mean, you can call it a label,
yeah.
but it's them.
It's a legal entity, but it is them, basically. Yeah. Because Roy's in the same situation with his science fiction stuff, so, where he managed to get all his old recordings on board.
I mean, you could put out a CD and have it called something, but it's still you, so
yeah.
why? It's not a label.
So have the record companies got a future, or will they just die, do you think?
I don't know about that. They're really struggling, especially in America.
They are, yeah.
Because the sales, it's so easy to go on the internet and download.
Well,
and
they are paranoid about piracy. My view is, though, that people are only doing as much piracy as they ever did with cassette tapes and so on. I think
exactly.
it's exactly the same thing. And that, in a way, that serves to promote it.
Yeah.
Because people then go and see it live, you know, and then they think, well, I'll get a proper quality version of this
yeah.
and buy a CD. So I think they're just running scared, actually, you know.
Possibly so.
Well,
I mean, the good thing about record companies is you use their money for all the promotion, even though it's your money eventually.
Yeah.
But they'll go ahead and put it up front, and they'll promote, yeah. and they'll get you out there.
Yeah.
The other way of the internet, you got it. It's all.
Well, if you're a starting out musician now, you know, and let's say you're playing in your mum's in the basement of your mum's house or whatever, and sticking stuff out on the internet.
Yeah.
You don't have that push.
Really,
you really don't. So in a way, it seems almost a bit more random.
Yeah.
On the other hand, I mean, MySpace seems to be enormously popular for people just to browse around and find tracks.
Oh, yeah.
So I don't know. I'd like there to be a way for people to say, you know, these are the artists I like, these are the, what else can I listen to? And I know there are services like that. There's
yeah.
a thing called Pandora,
yeah.
Which we talked about recently, which is like an online music station. And once it knows what you like, it will start recommending other stuff.
Right.
And it uses some, you know,
kind of like Devo.
Yeah. It uses some weird algorithms to do that. So maybe that is the future. Maybe people will just stop buying physical CDs and just carry around everything.
I do really miss the old 12-inch.
Yeah.
know, where you get an album cover and you can read.
Right.
Well, I missed that part of it.
I used to spend hours and hours poring over, you know, your gatefold sleeve covers, your
yeah.
Pink Floyd sort of, you know, Hypnosis covers, which had so much detail in the artwork, and you could sit there and completely immerse yourself in the music,
yeah,
and immerse yourself in the artwork and read the lyrics and everything else.
Yeah, something to hold and look at.
And everybody's, it's much more disposable now. You download it on your iPod, give it a listen, you know. And I'm showing my prejudices here, talking about.
I feel the same way.
Talking about my liking for long, complicated music as well. I like listening to whole albums, and I like just sitting in a chair and doing that. And
yeah.
Being less casual about the whole thing, and I think that's changed as well. You know, but that's to do with like consuming of singles and bringing out single tracks.
Yeah.
And I've never really, you know, it's not really been my sort of thing. So if you're writing at the moment, you're not signed to a label, and you're not, I mean, do you own any of your own recordings from the past, or are they still through?
I own all of them.
Yeah. Well, that's the way to go, isn't it?
I'm not going to sign that away. That's me. That's me.
Silly.
Well, my ex-wife owns some of the earlier stuff.
Oh, well, okay. Yeah,
but
yeah.
We won't go there.
No, probably better not, really. Is there any chance of you ever working with Roy again, or do you
I'd
think that time's
to.
Gone?
I would love to. I really would. If there's anything left that I would like to do, that's one of them.
Well, he's working on new material, and it's taking a long time.
I've actually told him before, when I knew he was going to do a gig or something,
yeah.
that I would pay my own expense if he would just, if we could play together again.
Yeah.
And yeah, there's a lot of work to work out and all that, but I'd still do it.
You see, the thing is, in recent years, his touring has all been him and the accompanist, guitarist, and there hasn't been a full band. But he started talking about, in his bleaker moments, talking about things like farewell tours and all that kind of stuff. Yeah, well, that's how I feel about it as well.
It could be like the Eagles. This is the first farewell tour. This is the second farewell. This is the Hell Froze Over tour.
That's right. And in case you missed the last three, here's another one.
Yeah, here's another one. Or what's her name? Cher.
Oh, yeah, that's right. Yeah, it never quite goes away.
I got an interesting story about Cher. I was in L.A. recording with this band called Jimmy Davis and Junction back in the 80s. Cher, the guy from... Toto was producing.
Oh, yeah.
So she was in the next studio, and then Fleetwood Mac was upstairs in the third studio. But Cher told this guy producing, she said, I'll give you 2 hours per track, and that's it.
Oh, really?
If there's mistakes or whatever, I'm sorry. That's just the way it is.
Mm.
Sure enough, after she had finished, there were mistakes everywhere. So she wouldn't come back in to fix it. He hired this male Cher impersonator
to come in
and fix the track, and nobody knows that. Maybe I shouldn't have said that.
You didn't know it until now.
I think
now
just,
they know.
I think we'll just say allegedly on that one.
Allegedly.
That normally gets you out of
allegedly,
trouble, doesn't it?
A male Cher man came in.
You got any more stories like that?
I got millions of them. Millions.
Wow. Is there anything you'd like to promote? What's the address of your MySpace page, first of all? You can remember. If not, I'll stick it on the end as a...
Actually, I wasn't going to do a music MySpace.
Yeah.
Because I had a little personal thing.
Yeah.
But there's a lady here named Sue Catwoman from the 70s.
Uh-huh.
That she and I have been good friends for 30 years. How long? At least 30 years. And...
I was just a teenager.
I hadn't heard from her during all this time,
right.
But we were real tight and
great
friends. And she got in touch with me through MySpace, and we got to talking and renewed the friendship and all that. And she said, "Oh, you need to do a music page, you know, so people can hear this stuff."
Right.
I said, "Well, why not?" And now it's just starting to mushroom.
Yeah,
it's only been there a month.
That's right, you did it in June, I think, because it says on when the page was made on MySpace.
Yeah.
And I thought, oh, yeah, he's only recently done that.
It's mushrooming, which is good, you know, because that's some stuff they can't hear, like John Carbo.
Yeah.
I got a Philip Rambo track on there, I think. I also did about 6 years ago, maybe. A friend of mine I worked with, a songwriter named Keith Sykes, he wrote a lot of stuff for Jimmy Buffett and Roseanne Cash and Rodney Crowell and different people over there. But he said, I saw this Haydn Quartet thing once. And he said, I wondered what it would be like.
I listened to that on your page this morning.
He said, I wonder what it would be like for a guitar, electric guitar. So I found this guy, a great guitar player. He played all the violin parts of the Haydn, and I played all the cello parts on electric bass. And we did the whole movement, you know, Opus 50. And then they took it on further and added some Beethoven and all that.
Right.
But I never really read music like that.
Yeah.
The dots.
Yeah.
But so I had to force myself to learn really quickly.
Oh, right. Okay.
And, man, I think it's cool.
Well, as I said, I was listening to it this morning. That's my kind of thing. You know?
Yeah.
I like it technically complicated. And
I wouldn't mind doing a tour doing that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
Just see how it goes.
Yeah. I'll give out your MySpace address at the end so people can listen to that and other bits and pieces. I mean, is there anything else you'd like people to look at? Either in terms of stuff you've made or stuff you want to turn people onto?
Not at this point. I don't know. I mean, still my favorites are Roy and those kind of things, because I listen to Roy's music all the time, even the stuff I didn't play on. I don't like to listen to stuff I played on, because I start to be critical.
Oh, I can imagine that.
Of what I did, not what the big picture's about.
Yeah.
But like, I listened to a version of Peter Gabriel and Kate Bush doing Another Day.
That's really emotive, isn't it?
Oh,
emotional.
Great.
Yeah.
And then I had to go back and listen to the original Another Day, and I thought, I forgot how good this really was.
It's one of his most sort of poignant songs.
Yeah.
If you're in the right frame of mind, or the wrong frame of mind, it can, you know, bring a tear to the eye.
Well, I like his new one about the black cloud over Islam, too.
Oh, yeah.
That's the Roy I know.
Well, he got a lot of stick for that, but I like the angry Roy as well as the love songs Roy. And the fact that you get both of those in the same package, and in the gigs you swing from anger to sweetness.
But that's Roy.
Very effective. Well, it is, yeah.
That's why we're friends. I mean, me and my woman, the black cloud thing, it's all, it's still, you know, I know what he's saying.
Well, I don't know.
I like what he says.
I don't know of an artist that is quite so upfront about things, but also I don't know an artist that resonances so well with my sort of twisted worldview, you know. I think most of the people that like his stuff are like that.
He don't hold back.
No.
That's for sure. I mean, he'll let it out. Sometimes he's his own worst enemy, but you know I am too.
Well, you know, it's the thing about not toeing the line and not doing what you're told to, not conforming just for the sake of it, you know.
Did he ever tell you about the time at the Troubadour in LA that the audience wasn't quite paying attention?
Don't know.
So he just had a piss right there on stage.
That is a famous story, but I never knew what venue it was.
It was a Troubadour.
So now we know.
Los Angeles.
Now we know. What, were you there?
No, but I know about it.
No, that's right, because it was before. It was when he brought Stallcock out, I think, or something like that.
That's right.
What people said. Well, that's the one way of, you know, getting attention, I suppose.
It's true.
That hasn't happened in recent years, actually, fortunately. Although he does tend to expose bits of his anatomy occasionally, which is equally disturbing, frankly.
Any of the stories about the Continental Riot House or Troubadour, they're probably true.
No, right. Yeah, well. Okay.
Can I ask you, going back to those, when you were on tour with Gyps, what was that? Like, do you look back on those times with fond memories? Because it looked back for what? I mean, because I can remember you doing Grown Ups and just Silly Children.
Oh, that's
it was
a great
like
track.
A lighter side of
Roy. Oh, yeah.
Ways that
well, in square boxes.
The
and
of the other musicians
I had a great time. There, when we went to record in this studio in Wales called Rockfield, and I think that may have been part of the beginning of the Gyps band. But when I got there, it's like a house you stay in, and then the studio's down this little lane, and it's all out in the country. I got to the room that they said would be my room, and this horrible, horrible stink. So I burn all this incense, and we go and rehearse, and I come back, and it just still stinks and stinks. Couldn't figure it out, and I said, there's got to be something in here that's so horrible, stinking, you know. And it turns out that Ozzy Osbourne had been recording there the week or something before, and I pulled back the mattress from the bed, and there's a dead fish under there.
Oh God!
And it already started, you know, rotting, and no wonder it stinks.
I thought you were going to say a bat, but fish is.
They had to take out the whole bed and everything, just. Throw it away. But those days, Andy Roberts is really, well, I saw Dave, but Andy Roberts is one of the few I've seen since those days.
Yeah.
I'd like to see Halsey. I heard he owns a pub in Barnet or somewhere. I'm not sure.
In Barnet?
So. That's not far. That's not far from
he
here.
He has
is
a
it?
Pub there, or he had a pub there. That'd be just perfect.
Yeah.
Because Halsey was that kind of guy. He's like an entertainer. And
it would be Bon Vivre type, you know, host thing going on.
And McCulloch, I've tried to get in touch. He's back in Ireland. He's on MySpace, but I've tried to get in touch with him. And Carol Grimes did the same thing. For some reason, either he's not getting it or somebody else is running his MySpace.
Oh, that happens quite a lot, yeah. Or you even get imposters, don't you?
Yeah, but I've never heard back.
Yeah.
And when I first moved back to America, he tried to get in touch through other people, and then every time I would write him, he'd already moved somewhere else.
Okay.
Well, so, Henry, if you're out there...
I was going to say, in the perhaps likely event that the word will reach these people when they listen to this, then, you know, go for it. This is one of the nice things about MySpace and that kind of stuff. It really is this networking tool, isn't it? And it's working brilliantly.
I would have never met you again. after all these years.
Yeah.
I mean, it's only been because she was just a kid.
Well, she's when still very young, obviously.
Oh, yeah, she can't be more than 30.
And he was very shy, as I remember. Well, not very shy, but he seemed quite quiet and shy.
Me?
Yeah.
Oh, get out.
That was probably an act, you know.
Some things I probably should have kept the same.
Well, who knows? Okay, I think we'll leave it there for the interview. We've done half an hour. Brilliant.
Thank you for asking me.
If you think of any more Scurrilous stories, we'll have you back on.
I got a million stories if you ever want to. I got Albert King stories, I got Mick Ronson stories, I got more Roy Harper stories.
Okay, well, maybe when you're back in America, we'll do one over Skype or something. But
I was coming through when I was playing with Albert right before he died.
Mm.
We landed in Charles de Gaulle Airport, and he used to call me Little Round Man.
Oh, yeah.
And so we landed in Charles de Gaulle. We're walking down the, you know, the thing when you come off the plane.
Yeah.
And he said, Round Man? He said, I got to learn to speak some of this Spanish. I said, Spanish? I said, why is that? And he said, well, I understand what they say to me. I just want to be able to say it back. The very first gig I did with Albert King was at the Fox Theater in Atlanta. It's a really lovely old, well, old compared for us.
Yeah.
Theater. I mean, you know, really nice. And I asked him, I said, well, Albert, you know, because we'd always recorded, we never played live. I said, what do you want me to wear? Because I don't know what you...
Sure.
And he said, well, it's an old hippie gig. It really don't matter.
Yeah.
And so I wore a tuxedo anyway, because that's the way they do things. So we get there, we're playing, and the band opens up with them Changes by Buddy Miles, you know. And it's sounding loud, and I'm feeling, oh, it feels good. Everything seems right. First thing he does, he walks out on stage and he unplugs all the drum mics.
Oh, yeah.
I'm thinking, well, you know, what's going on? But we keep playing. And then he, halfway through the show, he goes over to the keyboard player and unplugs the lead right from the keyboard player's amp.
Right.
So that's useless.
That's gone.
After the show, he said, Round Man, can you come up to my dressing room? I said, sure. I go out there and he said, could you hear the keyboard player? Well, I said, no, Albert, I couldn't. He said, you know what that means, don't you? Yeah, I knew what it meant. But I said, no, what does that mean? He said, it means he ain't worth the shit. Because if he was worth the shit, he would want you to hear him. Keyboard player never played another gig with
I was going to say, no, not invited back. I didn't want to come back.
But anyway, man.
Okay, Dave thanks. Cochran.
Thanks for asking me here.
It's been a real pleasure. Thank you very much.
My pleasure.
Thanks again, Dave, for taking the time to give me that interview. Really good. I really enjoyed myself that day. It feels like such a long time ago now, actually. But there you go. Dave actually went off to have dinner with Roy later that day because Roy was over in London. So the pair of them had a good time. And there were some photos from that event on MySpace if people want to dig around on Dave's profile there. Brilliant stuff. Okay, now another track from that era that Dave worked with Roy on. And this is going to be Grown Ups Are Just Silly Children. Again, this is actually from the BBC Tapes, Volume 5.
Let your dingle dangle in the dust.
Thank you.
Now it's time for the A to Z of Harper, and we've reached N. And there's quite a few songs beginning with N in Roy's canon, but I've picked Naked Flame. For me, this is another prime example of Roy's ability to construct beautiful poetry, and it's a very bittersweet song about the ending of a relationship that couldn't survive. And I think it's best summed up by reading what Roy says about it in his lyric book. A song from the broken heart of love's sad clown. An impossible relationship pulled apart by external tensions. At the end of summer, the trees start to open up again as leaves are lost, dripping the old year from branches which once were full. Sadness. Even though there may be a child, a bright-eyed seed in the wind, the only thing to do is to ride off into the morning and come to terms with the eternal vitriol. I wrote this with a Brooklyn country pen. Darn right peculiar.
The naked flames of cracking dawn come searing through with cruel scorn to furrow wounds across each frown inside the rest of love's sad clown who chases fleeting silhouettes with swollen dreams and rising sweats. Who taunts and bluffs the savage god with a broken heart and a hanging head. I would we were, but I wish in vain to have you here to hold again. My blood boils ice in deep despair, but worst of all, you couldn't care. Remember when the world was ours, and at our feet 10,000 stars. Who saws then could now relate? Who would have guessed? This was our fate. Sorry that you thought of us as painful and superfluous, but please don't think I'm the thick skin to want my seed in any old wind. I can't believe we'll just exist as figments of each other's past. Where is it at to get to this? When Laura's luck lover's kiss. The altar of October stands with opening arms and dripping hands, unveiling stones, collecting skies, and gathering leaves to whisper sighs. As from the pulpit summer shrinks, and hope abides, together sinks, as fast as all those burning lights. Just as hard, hard to memorize. The ages pass with the flick of a thumb. Love has lost and pride has won, but through all destruction flies new dawn, and I rode the winds into the morn.
Now it's time for listener feedback. I didn't run any feedback during the 3-episode Roy Harper interview. I wanted to wait until the whole thing had got out there. And I got quite a lot of feedback, as you can probably imagine. So all I've done is I've picked some of the feedback that really summed up what people had to say. And the first one is from Dave Owen. Dave says, "Well done, Paul. It was great to hear Roy with his many and varied opinions and stories. I was sad to hear about his health problems. I felt kind of privileged to be told about his personal business. I didn't quite understand why Between Every Line couldn't be released as a double CD. Gatefold cardboard mini LP sleeve would be fabulous. I hope we haven't seen the last of him on stage. He's still a great performer. I wonder why the fans haven't bought the DVD in any great numbers. It's a top piece of work and Roy's obviously proud of it. He should have mentioned it when you asked him what he was proud of. As ever, he was modest. I don't have to be modest for him. He's the best songwriter ever. He hardly has any real duds. His output stands proudly head and shoulders above everybody else's, and he's not finished yet. Good news that Roy has half a new CD ready. Let's hope he hits a creative streak and gets on with it. I'll continue to spread the word about the great Roy Harper. Maybe this tribute album will do some good in that department. Does Roy know about it? Has he heard any of the tracks? Is there any info about any other covers of Roy's songs on the Stormcock community? I've checked them out on YouTube. Some are okay. If I don't stop soon, I'll have written a book. Once again, well done and thanks, but most of all, hats off to Roy Harper. Love, Dave." Just in a quick response to that, yes, Roy does know about these tribute tracks, and in fact, it was Tracy that alerted me to the existence of the MySpace page, so he does know about it. There are some other covers around there. Maybe one of these days I'll see if I can get permission to play one or two of them. And in fact, there is a cover coming soon that I've heard about, and I'm trying to get permission to play that on the podcast soon as well. Webby Lars says, "This podcast certainly clears up Roy's current position on gigging, etc. Thanks again, Paul. The whole interview felt like it was bathed in sunshine, possibly the nearest thing to a summer some of us got. I think giving Roy the space to answer questions in his inimitable rambling style was a masterstroke. He always managed to pull it back to the question in hand, even after the listener had long forgotten what it was. But I have to admit, I enjoyed the interruptions the most. Tony! 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 So now we know what Mr. Blair is doing for a job these days. He's cutting Roy's grass." Shane says, "Nice one, Paul. Thanks for this interview. This last one is the most interesting I've found. It's encouraging to hear he's thinking 3 albums into the future. The touring news is slightly alarming, though. Being a young lad, I've only seen him play 11 times, plus the guitar workshop, and only one of those was less than superb. I could happily keep going to Roy Harper gigs for many years to come. One of the things I like about being an RH fan is that putting on an album or going to a gig is like dipping into a lucky bag. It doesn't matter if the gig isn't as good as the last one or if the methane zone comes on because Miles Remains will be on soon and the next gig you might get Short and Sweet or something. And the bag itself is magical. The gigs, the albums, the book, the DVD and whatever else, this interview, all seem to me to be one self-contained thing, a life's work, I suppose. And some bits are better than others, but it seems to have a consistent backdrop and character and sense of purpose no matter where you dip in. I don't always agree with or like the stuff he prattles on with sometimes, but I like the sense I always get from his records and gigs, etc., that he sticks to his guns and lives life rather than just passes through it. And that's always a good thing to see and try and take example from. Sorry, that's a bit waffly. No, that was really well put, Shane. Thanks very much for that. And I think the life's work, the whole spreading of Roy's sort of opinion on things and his outlook on life comes across, as you say, in whatever media he chooses to present it in. And I think that consistency shows that it's not an act. He really believes in what he's saying. And I think those of us that are into his stuff really appreciate that for what it is. Windjammer says, this brings me to Roy's comments about any future gigs, stating the obvious, he's a 67-year-old man who has been in poor health, hopefully over it now, so obviously tours involving a lot of mileage are very tiring. However, his idea of London, Birmingham, Manchester, Newcastle and maybe Scotland would still leave vast areas of the country untouched. At last year's Penzance gig, he said how much he enjoyed coming to Cornwall because it was so like Ireland and he hoped he could come again, but obviously his health problems have got in the way. As he is happy in Clonakilty and Matt Churchill is just down the road, why doesn't he do another video, but this time at home? After all, wasn't part of the Death of God video shot there? There wouldn't be hordes of Harper fans' carbon footprints across the Irish Sea, if you believe the man is responsible for global warming myth, but that's another story. On the subject of the podcast interviews, might I suggest that at times you're too reverential? Yes, you and I and all the others who listen to the cast are Harper fans, but surely part of the enjoyment of the gigs was when somebody would argue with Roy and fire Roy up, which would enhance the show. To sit and treat everything that Roy says as being like tablets of stone handed down to Moses by God surely goes against everything that Roy stands for. Roy, just like you or I, talks complete bollocks at times. A good friendly argument would have enlivened the podcast up a bit. Anyway, I've rambled on too long, too much listening to Roy over the years, looking forward to the farewell gigs. Now, that actually made me think, and I am very conscious of the fact that podcasts can be very sycophantic, and I wouldn't be doing podcasting about Roy's music if I didn't really appreciate what he's done, and, you know, I'm a fan. And I knew that when I did the interview, I was in danger of we were in danger of disappearing up our own arses, so to speak. But the point was that Roy hadn't been in the public light for a long time. I knew about the health problem, the prostate cancer, and I was really hoping to give him a platform to talk and to fill people in with what he'd been up to and what he was hoping to do in the future, and just give him a platform, as I say. I think that if I get the chance to do another one with him, then perhaps we'll try and get a bit more pithy about certain things. And especially now that I know what to expect when I sit down at a table with Roy for what I think is going to be an hour or two and ends up being a whole afternoon. I know what to expect, and I think we can have a bit more contention next time perhaps, but maybe not. I don't know. We'll see. Thanks for the opinion, Windjammer. I really appreciate that. I think in general terms, with the rest of the feedback I got, people were very, very pleased to hear from Roy again. They were alarmed that he'd been ill, although I hope that that's helped explain some of the fact that he's not been in the public eye so much and has gone pretty quiet. I mean, you would too if you'd been through something like that. And people are excited that he's... brain is obviously still working at full pelt. The thought processes are all there. The poet is still there, and let's hope that long may he continue producing things for us. Now, now some of the credits and legal stuff. This podcast is issued under Creative Commons Attribution, Non-Commercial, No Derivative Works 2.0 UK, England and Wales license, which basically means you can share it with others freely, but you can't change it, claim you made it, or charge any money for it. The Roy Harper music in this podcast is used by kind permission of Science Friction Limited and is not for copying or redistribution. The intro music is by kind permission of Adam Leonard. The background music to the feedback was by Greg Williams from his album A Circle of Hidden Intentions. The tracks were So Lovely, So Lonely and Him. You can find Greg's music at www.magnatune.com. Some links. All your Roy Harper needs can be found at www.royharper.com. If you want to help the podcast, reviews on iTunes, if you use iTunes, are always welcome. If you've got lots of spare cash, send a little bit to me. There's a donation button on the stormcock.net website to help with the hosting fees and so on and so forth. Feedback, I'm always happy to get feedback. I like it via email, and if I get a text email, I'll read out selected bits and pieces, as you've already heard. But I also really like getting voicemail, so it's not just my voice on the podcast. You can record yourself into an MP3, WAV, or whatever takes your fancy and email it to me, pd@stormcock.net. Or if you can't do MP3 recording, then you can ring me on a plain old telephone, 01223 850 282. Or if you're not in the UK, +44 1223 850 282. There's a 90-second limit on those, so you have to be succinct, and I'll be happy to play those. Okay, we're wrapping things up for this month. I'm going to play a long track from HQ now to finish off the Dave Cochran theme, and this is going to be The Game, one of my favourite tracks, of course. And I'll be seeing you in November. The November podcast will probably be a little bit late because Vicky and I are off for a late holiday to Turkey for the last 2 weeks in October. And so, of course, it won't be ready when I come back, but it will be out early November. And until then, enjoy the strangely late summer that we've had this weekend in the UK. And see you next time. Bye for now.
The habits I've got and more than
back to my children. Oh, without a question.
Lovers alone in the past is almost a phase.